Hi, I'm Connie Loizos.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Hello, all. Well, this was for many a slow news week, but for us, not so much. I think readers of the Strictly VC newsletter or TechCrunch or Axios caught the news, but in case not, Strictly VC has been acquired by Yahoo, and I've been made the general manager and editor-in-chief of TechCrunch, which is also owned by Yahoo. It is a little surreal, even though anyone who's been through this process knows that it takes months to get right. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't a little bittersweet selling a business that I started building a full decade ago and that I imagined we'd have for a very long time into the future. But there really is not a better place to grow the newsletter than at TechCrunch, which can provide it many more resources. At the same time, I get to continue working with my colleagues at TechCrunch, who I truly respect so much, and I'm eager to work with in this leadership role. And finally, I am really excited to be learning how to run something at a much larger scale. This week, I really did feel like I was drinking from the proverbial fire hose. There were many, many meetings. I am so tired right now, but I just feel very lucky and excited about the future, and I hope that listeners will come along for the ride. That would make me very happy. Okay, but enough about my news. Let's get into someone else's news before jumping into this week's interview with Heidi Roizen, a former operator and entrepreneur who has spent the last 20 years as a VC, many of them with Threshold Ventures. I've been talking to Heidi about different stories across much of that time, and we enjoyed just talking shop with her late last week. We'll get to that chitter chatter in just a few minutes, but here's that news story before we do.
It's no secret that Americans hate their cable TV providers. According to a 2022 survey by CableTV.com, the average monthly cost of an expanded basic TV service package is $78, while the average monthly cable package, which includes internet service, is $217 per month, $12 more than the average amount that consumers pay for all of their utilities. Not surprisingly, folks are cutting the cord in droves. In the first 3 months of 2023, cable TV providers lost 2.3 million subscribers. Now the industry is finally acknowledging the mess they are in. Today, Charter Communications, the second largest cable operator in the U.S., shared an 11-page presentation with investors that paints a grim future for the future of cable TV. Customers are leaving the traditional video ecosystem and losses have accelerated, the presentation read, conceding that cable had become too expensive for both consumers and providers. It also cited a, quote, staggering 25% drop in subscribers over the past 5 years. On a conference call with Wall Street investors, Charter's CFO added that Charter's business is, quote, at the edge of a precipice. It's easy to see why Charter may be feeling a bit grumpy. The company is mired in a tough negotiation with Disney, which is demanding that Charter pay a steep price to carry its channels, ESPN chief among them. Disney has pulled these channels from Charter, leaving the cable TV provider's 15 million subscribers with no access to many of their favorite shows and sporting events, a particularly cruel state of events given we're at the start of the college football and NFL season. Still, Charter's decision to disparage its own business model caught investors by surprise, causing its stock price to fall by more than 3.5%. Other players also suffered, with the stock price of Warner Brothers Discovery, which owns CNN, dropping a whopping 12%. Charter may be pleading poverty in order to coax Disney to the negotiating table, but its move today shows just how thoroughly streaming apps have disrupted the traditional cable model. It also means that consumers may have to subscribe to many different streaming services in order to find the shows they want to watch. All of which begs the simple question, isn't technology supposed to make our lives easier?
Up next, our interview with Heidi Roizen. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Disrupt, the original startup conference, stays fresh, relevant, and focused on founders, investors, and the future of tech year after year. Don't miss this year's show with Kevin Systrom, Dario Amade, Katie Hahn, Shaquille O'Neal, Meredith Whitaker, and Reed Jobs, among others. The event takes place in San Francisco. The dates, September 19th to the 21st. It's coming up fast. Grab your tickets today.
It's great to be reconnecting with you here. It's always so fun to talk with you. And you were so nice to come to a Strictly VC event of mine. Maybe it's like 6 years ago now. Time goes by so fast, but it's been too long since we've had a detailed conversation. So Heidi, I want to talk to you first and foremost about your new podcast. So tell us a little bit about what you are working on, because you're famous in the Valley for dispensing great advice at Stanford and across other mediums for years. So why start this podcast?
Yeah, it's definitely something I'd thought about for many years, but finally got the impetus to do it. My partners always joke that I'm the person around the table who has seen it all and been in the room for whatever. I've been on over 40 boards and been doing this for almost 25 years. And so a lot of times, like Josh or Emily will say, if one of the more junior partners says, I'm dealing with this situation, they'll say, oh, call Heidi. So we were chatting about that late last year and they said, hey, why don't you try to articulate that stuff and put it down. And so we thought that the podcast format was an interesting one because we're trying to reach early stage entrepreneurs. And I know a lot of them listen to podcasts. And we went out and we looked at a lot of the podcasts that VCs do. And a lot of them are quite long and they're interview style and they're tell me about how you did this thing or they're pontificating on sectors or whatever. And we really decided, hey, we want to try something really different, which is just talk about oh shit moments that entrepreneurs face, and then talk about how would you get through these moments and what have we seen work and what have we seen not work. And sometimes the entrepreneur has a situation that we can't fix, but we can at least tell you how you might want to avoid it. So that's the idea. And then we really wanted it to be fun. So we have this Sherlock Holmesy sort of music, and we position everything as the case of the this or the case of the that. And we just try to have some fun with it so that I envision you're an entrepreneur, you're running a company, and you can take 10 to 15 minutes out of your day, you're walking to something or doing something, and you can just learn a little bit about a particular topic. And maybe that topic's super relevant. I've done stuff on down rounds and whether or not you should let your in-laws invest in your startup. And I've done things that are more generic and general, like today's episode that I just unleashed on the world is one about how a founder impacts the culture with their actions. So much more general. Some of them are much more specific, but I'm having a lot of fun doing it, obviously.
That's great. And I love that they are short compared with a lot of podcasts. I mean, to your point, these are busy founders who you're talking with. And I love that you're just diving in. Here's the advice and go on with your day. I was curious, obviously, down rounds, big topic this year. Is there any non-conventional wisdom here? I mean, I've talked to VCs throughout the year. Everyone said right away, look, take the down round. It's better to take a lower valuation than accept all kinds of crazy structure just to maintain some superficial appearance that your company is worth more than it is. Is that basically the same advice that you're giving?
In some ways it's the old adage that common sense isn't that common. And the funny thing is that venture capitalists will say, yeah, just take the lower valuation. And yet what you hear entrepreneurs do all the time is they talk about their valuations, right? As another VC once said to me when I first became a VC, valuation is the grade at the top of the paper. And so part of what I try to do is also tell you why. So in the case of the podcast, I literally do some math. And let's face it, podcasts and math don't go that well together, but I do have it backed up on a blog post to explain it in more detail and have the spreadsheets to literally walk someone through and say, look, it's relevant when you're trading downside protection for a higher upside return in extremely upside cases. Generally speaking, most of your cases will not be super upside, right? Most of the startups end up playing out in the mid-range in their ultimate liquidity opportunities. And so you, entrepreneur, should run the math and just make sure you understand that when you're giving downside protection, that's probably going to come out of your own pocket. And so I think it's one thing to tell people, oh, terms are more important than valuation. It's another thing to show someone, hey, you're going to walk away with 24% if you do this, but you're going to walk away with 48% if you do that. So I think that's part of what I'm trying to do is just help get people's head around these things and then give them real examples.
What about some hairy terms like participating preferred? How do you talk to entrepreneurs about that?
Yeah, I mean, again, it all washes out in the numbers. So many times what people don't realize, the early stage entrepreneurs, is just run the math. And the reality is when you've done multiple rounds and they have different terms and some of it's senior and some of it might be participating and some of it might have a multiple, it's actually really hard to do the math. I mean, it's actually not that simple to do the maths. And so it's complicated to build some of these spreadsheets, but you really need to do that because you need to understand what is each person going to walk away with. In part too, it's not just understanding by class or by round, it's understanding by voter. Because many of your investors may participate in multiple rounds. They may be bigger in one round, smaller in another round, and they're going to do the math based on what they're going to get out of this deal. And so understanding that, especially if you have things like senior preferences and multiples on some and not on others and all that stuff, it's going to really impact how different people are going to vote. And remember, people can vote on either approving your M&A or whatever it is you're doing or your next round, or they can vote against it. And so understanding that math and understanding the human implications of how some of that works, I think is, again, it's another hidden layer that most people don't think about until it's too late. If you're doing the spreadsheet because you already have an offer on the table, you probably should have done that much earlier in your process.
It's interesting even to hear Alex say participating preferred, because that's a term that we did not hear for many years and that has resurfaced this year. What are some of the other things that founders are needing advice with this year? Because the go-go market went on for so long, they were not exposed to previously, and they really don't know how to deal with. Like, what are some of the issues that you've seen bubble up this year that you didn't in 2020, for example?
There's a lot going on right now that entrepreneurs need to be aware of. And again, the financing world is just one component. Everything was up and to the right for so many years that entrepreneurs had never been in a market correction before. That's why something like the idea of don't fight for valuation, fight for simple terms is important, because your gut reaction might be to protect that valuation because you identify with it. Another thing might be your business model, right? When capital is cheap, you spend capital to put the pedal to the metal on growth. Mm. But when capital is not cheap, growth at all costs is probably not a good idea. And so there is a trade-off there with burn versus growth, that people have just not had to make that trade-off for a long time, or in the case of many of these entrepreneurs, ever, right? I mean, what was the bull market now? I think 11, 12 years. Yeah. There are people in their early 30s who are running companies who have never seen a bear market. And so I think there's all sorts of things around that. Compensation is another place where you really have to look at it and say, we need to right-size the compensation. Obviously, because we have a lot of remote workers, and how does comp vary if you're not in a high-priced area? I mean, I think there's a whole bunch of things that are moving around right now. And I don't necessarily have the answers to all of this stuff, right? I mean, I was just working on a future episode about secondaries, another huge topic, right? And I say, look, I don't have answers. But what I do have is 20 some years of experience through multiple cycles, where I can at least tell you what you should be thinking about and how other people have maybe made those trade-offs. But at the end of the day, you're the founder, you're the CEO, you do you. I'm just giving you some different perspective on things, but not telling you what to do.
Sure. But those insights, I'm sure, are very helpful. Secondaries, I do think, are so fascinating. It's so interesting, obviously, because they were so verboten for a long time, or at least people didn't talk about them. It was something shameful if you were selling secondary shares, whether you were a founder or an investor. Then it became, of course, very smart and very widely accepted. Take some money off the table, buy yourself a house. Then it got really bananas.
a lot of money was the Netflix documentary material.
Right, exactly. The very smart founder of Hopin, who took off something like $200 million off the table right away within the first 2 years of the company's founding. And we know how that story has played out subsequently. I am interested in just bringing things to the news cycle. Tiger Global, it was reported yesterday, and the information is nearing a sale for part of its stake in a very buzzy AI company called Cohere.
Yep.
It's said to be selling 2.1% of its stake and keeping 5%. And I guess that 2.1% right now is worth whatever it invested initially. So basically, it's just taking the money that it put into the company and taking it out. Tiger's reportedly having liquidity issues. So I'm interested in what you think of that. And also, I'm just wondering, Cohere is, again, a buzzy company. And so even if you think it's Tiger that has to do this, you kind of also think, I don't know, shouldn't it be hanging on to the stake at all costs? This is still a very young company. Like, what the signal is that to the market about Cohere, if any?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think it's more of an indicator about Tiger than Cohere. It's a very small percent. Tiger is purportedly in a cash crunch. And they're portfolio managers. You know, they look around at their holdings and they say, gee, we have a bunch that if we were to try to sell in a secondary, we'd have to take a loss. We have Cohere where it's even money. And so we can book that and it doesn't hit our books that bad. We return the money to the LPs and it's a wash. So I'm sure they're looking internally and they're saying, how are we holding this? And part of those are rational decisions. And part of those are psychological decisions, right? It's very hard to sell your losers, even though one, you would think, you know, the school of wisdom is like, I should hold my winners and sell my losers. Right. But that's not human psychology, right? Human psychology is, gosh, I paid 80 for this and it's at 20. I don't want to sell that because maybe it's going to come back. So who knows why people do the things they do.
I read that you are on an AI committee at Stanford, and
I am.
I would guess that you're very interested in this topic. Are you interested in the foundational language models or in more specific applications?
Well, I think at the end of the day, look, you have to be interested in everything. Right. I think that in a lot of ways where AI is right now is it reminds me of what John Doerr said many years ago about the early days of the internet boom. Right. He said it's actually underhyped. Right. The internet is actually going to be bigger than everyone thinks. And of course, what happened is ultimately, yes, it is. But we also had that thing called the dot-com bust where a lot of people lost a lot of money, a lot of investors. And so I think as an investor, you have to look at this because right now I feel like every company, it's like they're adding .ai on the end of their name, just like they used to add .com, and there's AI all over the pitch deck. And you really have to scrub under that and understand where real revenue can be generated in, let's call it 5 years or 3 years. It really depends on what your time frame to exit is, what stage you play. You know, Threshold is a Series A investor. So we usually figure that we're not going to get liquidity for probably 5 to 7 years. We are a firm that knows a lot about healthcare. We're a firm that knows a lot about enterprise SaaS. And so we tend to look at the kinds of applications that are going to be the next gen of the sectors that we already understand. Sure. So I think that's where we're looking. And I think you also have to look rationally at like, yes, we have to understand large language models, but they're very expensive, right? And I think, again, if you look at history and you look at what happened with respect to platforms and how you build startups on the backs of these major tech shifts and major innovations and major platforms. And so I think one of the things we're really interested in looking at is who can sit on top of these large language models and do things in innovative ways that actually benefits healthcare or enterprise or the kinds of things that we invest in.
It's hard also, frankly, as a reporter to scrub some of these things because we are seeing so many things with AI, to your point. Speaking of AI and enterprise, one other thing I thought we could talk about, because I love your thoughts here, is Salesforce, again, going back to the information, also had an interesting report yesterday saying it's leading a big round in a company called Hugging Face.
Yes, I love that name.
I know. I was like, how of all the company names did they strike on
that? That sounds like one of those names that when you go on Amazon and you're buying a product that's actually a knockoff of something.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you read the user benefits, that somehow Hugging Face.
I know I should figure out from what that derives, but
hey, look, it's a name you remember. So
absolutely. But so Salesforce is leading that round, but Salesforce also has stakes, I believe, in Cohere, the company that we were just talking about,
yep,
and maybe Anthropic, which is one of the large language model companies too, that is fast growing. Those guys spun out of OpenAI. In terms of strategic partnerships, it seems like, especially with these AI companies, you really, really need them. I mean, you want Salesforce involved, you want NVIDIA, you want Oracle, maybe. I don't know if relationships here are any more important than it previously, but also when you partner with a company with the muscle of a Salesforce or an Oracle, there are downsides as well. It seems to like cut off other options. So it's a big question.
First of all, luckily, I recently did a podcast on this called The Case of the Strategic Sucker Punch. Look, strategic investors are a huge part of the financial ecosystem for entrepreneurs. So, I mean, I think something like 20% of all deals have a strategic investor in them. But the thing to understand about a strategic investor, a company like Salesforce or NVIDIA or any of the big ones, right, is I once said to an entrepreneur, look, when I invest in you, I only make money if your stock goes up. But when a strategic invests in you, they also make money if their stock goes up. And so to me, that summarizes something really important. Like I understand Salesforce paid 100 times revenue for that investment. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no public company trading at 100 times revenue. So if you're planning to sell that stock sometime in the future, that's a pretty aggressive price. But if you are also doing some coincident biz dev deal that is going to allow you to leverage what they have into your customer base and into your technology and into your new market segments, that makes your stock go up, right? And so that's where I think, again, we don't know, we're going to have to wait and see, but I would imagine that that's how they justified paying a price like that.
I guess as an entrepreneur, you'd have to be really careful about information rights and making sure that perhaps they don't attend board meetings or they're kept away from certain discussions.
Yeah, no, for sure. You really have to look at that. And you also have to look at all sorts of other ways that you may cap your ability to generate enterprise value by doing deals, right? If you give away an exclusivity to a segment, a vertical, to a geography, all of the things you do with a strategic have value to you as well, or lost value if you cede those. So I think you just have to be very thoughtful, very quote unquote strategic about how you deal with strategics, because they can have a huge impact on you, both positively and negatively.
And they have so much power right now, especially compared with venture firms. I know that there's still a lot of money on the sidelines, but obviously fewer firms are able to raise big funds right now. I think it took a while. Fundraising continued apace for quite a while, but I feel like in the last 3 or 4 months, I'm definitely hearing about fewer funds getting raised. And so another thing, Heidi, that I'm interested in your thoughts about is this started happening, God, I don't know, maybe like 15 years ago, where it used to be that US VCs had to focus very much on convincing Stanford and pension funds and hospital systems to invest in them. And I know that they still do, but they started looking farther abroad. They were looking to conglomerates in China and they were looking to sovereign wealth funds. And that's been tricky, obviously. Now we've got all these geopolitical issues with China and Saudi Arabia is a tricky partner to have. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about the future of VC and whether or not should be striking deals with these foreign partners.
For sure. Well, I mean, look, I think it's really interesting. I think VC grew magnificently because it was delivering returns, because the whole world has woken up to the leverage of technology companies. I mean, you look at the 10 most valuable companies on earth, right? And 5 of them have started as venture-backed tech startups. So there's a reason why money flooded into this economy. And I think also, again, for the last 11 years, you had what effectively a zero interest rate environment. And so all these large capital entities, whether they're pension funds or sovereign wealth or whatever they are, they had to go into what I would call higher beta or riskier enterprises in order to deliver the returns they wanted to deliver because they couldn't get it off interest rates. So not surprising that all that money is flowing. Sovereign wealth is actually very big. By the way, here's a little trivia question for you. Who is by dollar amount the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world?
Saudi Arabia?
I'll say Singapore.
Norway.
Huh.
Really?
So there you go. And they're pretty uncontroversial, right? So maybe you should just take Norwegian money.
That's really interesting. What is their sovereign wealth fund called?
The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund or something like that. Actually, I looked it up because I was writing another future podcast on the impact of what happens when there's an LP in the fund and you don't share their values, right? Or they do something that you really don't like. And how should you as an entrepreneur think about that? Either as a direct investment, which is usually more common, right? It's just that they're an LP in some funds and you have to think about that. And so, look, I mean, I think that the first thing, and it's one of the wonderful things about being an entrepreneur, is presumably you should be able to make that choice. look, all of us are in the backseat of the car and the entrepreneur is driving the car. We can't tell the entrepreneur what to do. That's a bad idea. And so the entrepreneur should be able to say, hey, I don't believe in that entity. I don't want to be contributing to their coffers. And I don't want to have the potential liability that if it were known they were one of my investors, that might make my employees unhappy, or that make my other investors unhappy, or that make my customers unhappy, whatever it is, right? So first and foremost, I think entrepreneur has to make a decision. Now, that said, I think that there are edge cases, right? If you're an entrepreneur and you absolutely believe you have the cure for cancer, but the only term sheet you got was from a fund that's on the opposite side of the political aisle from you, maybe you just decide, look, the net benefit to the world is that I get to cure cancer. And so I'm going to take this money. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's super simple, cut and dry, but I think that everybody gets to make that decision. From my own perspective and my own history of having investors that have funds with LPs that may not be, you know, the not be the ones choice. I want to hang out with, mm-hmm. the concern the entrepreneur has that that LP might have an influence on their firm, I think that's a very low concern. In all of my years doing this, I don't think I can think of a time where an LP reached through the GP and tried to influence or directly influence what the company was doing. So I think that is a very low risk. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the public reaction to your association with an LP, even if it's a very minimal thing, and by the way, some entrepreneurs, they have no idea who the LPs are in their funds. It's news to them when it happens. So, sure. I mean, one thing I'd say, dear entrepreneur, please ask when you're getting investment from a GP, from a venture fund, by the way, who are your LPs? And would any of them, if they were known, be detrimental to my target customer base? Because, for example, some LPs might be very misaligned with your brand and your target audience. Some other types of venture startups, the customer's not going to care where the money came from. Right. And you can probably guess what the delineation of those companies are. So I think you just need to be thoughtful about this stuff, but it's definitely a spectrum. And I think some people are going to choose not to take money from those places, and other people are going to say, it's okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think founders were accustomed to asking. I don't know if they're asking now, but of course, during the whole SoftBank drama, it's gotten a lot of funding from Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi. And during that whole famous sad incident with the reporter, I was calling around to founders to ask if people who'd received SoftBank money and money from other investors that were backed by those funds, if they wanted to come. And of course, nobody said anything, but I think in some cases it all came as very surprising and awful. And I don't know what they could have done at that point. It's not like you can get out of those relationships so easily either. So I do think, obviously, if you're a founder and these things matter a lot to you, ask those questions up front.
Well, I think those are the things that you really have to do. And it's one of the things that I talk to founders about a lot is you need to understand the business models of the other players you interact with. And one of them is your venture fund. Mm-hmm. There are things that I think an entrepreneur should understand about their VC, like where the money comes from, right? I had one entrepreneur once who raised 20-something million dollars. And I said to him one day, do you know where the money came from? And he said, yeah, rich people play money. And I said, absolutely not. You know, our fund, we have endowments, we have teachers unions, we have bus driver unions, and they don't give us the money and say, go have fun with it. They say, this is my retirement money. You need to deliver a return. And we are fiduciaries of that money. And we have an obligation to those LPs. And so I think it's important for entrepreneurs to understand that, because I think it helps to develop a healthy respect for that money and where that money came from and what the entrepreneur is committing to by dint of taking the money from a venture capitalist, that we are all on the hook for making that money have a return. Again, I think that that whole relationship and a mutual understanding, right? We are supposed to understand what the entrepreneur is doing. I think it benefits them to understand what we're supposed to be doing as well.
Do you share information with your entrepreneurs about what reserves you're targeting for the investment or what multiple you project for return on the investment, given firms are always modeling where their portfolios are in the cycle?
I mean, my immediate reaction is it would be bullshit to tell them what we expect for from them because the reality is you invest in every company having a reasonable idea based on their models and your assessment of their models, where it's going to go. And when you're early stage, like we are, you're talking about 20 to 40 people who are raising $10 million and who maybe have $1 million to $2 million in ARR, if you're lucky. And the truth is, it's so early days, you can't really know. And the reality is, if you look at the returns across venture funds, it's not like you average a 3x across 80% of your portfolio. A couple percent are going to every once in a while return the fund. And then there are going to be some who maybe they don't return the whole fund or multiples of the fund, but they'll return half the fund or a third of the fund. And then you got a bunch that, you know, one or two break even. And then you have a reasonable number, especially in markets like this, that don't make it. And you return less than capital, you know, whatever, call it 30%. And I mean, I'm throwing out these numbers, but I'm not far from, again, if I think of the history of my own funds that I've participated in and funds I've been an investor in, that's how it ultimately looks. So it's really more about, can you be a great partner to that entrepreneur all the way along? Can you help them battle test their models? Can you help them learn and adjust? I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting right now is a lot of entrepreneurs raised money at a time based on business models that are no longer valid because the world changed and we can't keep doing that. Like I said earlier about trading growth for profitability, for example. Well, the world changed. And yet I was talking to an entrepreneur recently who felt bad, didn't want to talk to his board about completely changing things because he felt like it was on him that they're going to think he lied to them 2 years ago. And I said, oh, for God's sake, no, nobody, we don't want you to waste our money on the original plan just because you feel bad about changing the plan. We want you to have a growth mindset and change the plan. And let's all work together and use the benefit of our knowledge because we don't know your company nearly as deeply as you do, but we know what's happening to 30 other companies right now. And we can use that information, again, not specifically, but generically to say, hey, look, this is what's happening in terms of revenue. And here are the things that are getting impacted in general. And here are the things you, Mr. or Ms. Entrepreneur or M entrepreneur, should be thinking about in terms of modifying things so that you don't run out of money, so that you don't have to raise money on a down cycle, so that all of these things are pointing you in the right direction to continue to be successful. So no, I mean, we don't have a specific goal. 10 years ago, I think I remember that maybe we used to have this quarterly thing where we maybe project what it might be worth. We don't do any of that. I mean, we're just like, let's just try to make this thing the best thing it can be and understand and learn from the market and be a partner to the entrepreneur. And so you asked about follow-on investments. As a general rule of thumb, when you're an early stage fund, you just don't have the capacity to pile it on to any particular investment, right? You're going to do probably 20 investments, 25 investments over the fund, your early stage. So let's call it an average of 10. So that's 250, where our fund is 375. You can't put 50 into something, even if it is taking off. I mean, that's just not the nature of what a Series A investor does. Mm-hmm. So we sort of say, look, you know, there's a chance that we'll put half again to as much again into an investment, but you may earmark that, right? Put it in a pool of follow-on potential, but you don't do it until the time that you make that decision, right? Mm-hmm. You have to look at it the time you make the decision. So it's very fungible, right? Things move around.
Sure, sure, sure. And I'm sure in some cases right now too, in terms of the advice that founders are getting, what they're communicating to you is, I'm sure in some cases they're just saying, take the capital back and we'll start from scratch.
Look, I think that that is another thing people don't talk about enough. And I think people should, which is sometimes you have an idea for a company and you work on it and you raise some money and you're toiling away. And then somebody comes out with a better product and it's a winner take all market, or something happens, right? The foundation you bet on, the other foundation turned out to be better for this particular application. I think that there's a lot of pressure on entrepreneurs, and frankly, there is some ego involved with many, that I've started a company, my mom's super proud of me, she tells everyone I'm a CEO, and I still have cash in the bank, so I'm just going to keep trying to pivot to make something work. And let's face it, pivots are Silicon Valley lore, right? And we all know that Twitter started as something different. And there are all these things about pivots that people talk about.
Except Heidi, they always talk about the same three pivots.
Yes, exactly. Because the other thousands have failed, right? And so I would say, look, we are in the risk business. We all try to do these things. We support the entrepreneur. But if it's not working, you don't have to keep flailing at it. Just say it didn't work, give the remainder of the money back, exit with honor, and everybody's going to be okay with that. It's not going to ruin your life. It's not going to ruin your career. It's not going to make our fund fail, right? I mean, if every company did that, sure, we would. But some of them are going to fail whether you admit it up front or admit it when you see it or not.
Right.
They're still going to fail. So it's another thing that we, the VC community, should not put pressure on or make entrepreneurs feel bad when everybody put their best efforts towards something and it didn't end up working. That's not being a bad person. That's just doing good things, but having a bad outcome. And nobody should be crawling away because that happened to them.
No, absolutely not. And Heidi, we've kept you too long. I so appreciate your time. One last quick question. The ARM IPO, it filed the paperwork this week. Everyone's so excited. They think this chip design company is going to be worth $40 to $80 billion. Blow open the IPO window. Do you think so?
Oh, do I have to answer that? I mean, every company that goes public is different. Mm-hmm. And I've never understood this concept of, well, the market's closed, but you take one company, one super big company, mm-hmm. and you put it out there and all of a sudden everybody gets to go public again. I just don't understand that. So no, no, I don't think it's going to blow the market open and the whole line is going to march out there and we're going to have 50 IPOs between now and December. No.
Okay, great. I agree with you, but it is interesting because I'm starting to see a lot of people talk about, well, yeah, we're preparing our paperwork as well now. So they're clearly hoping against the odds that that's going to happen. Anyway, Heidi, again, great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and special thanks to Disrupt, which takes place in San Francisco from September 19th to the 21st. Get your tickets today. Have a great weekend, and for folks in the U.S., have a great Labor Day weekend, and we'll see you back here next week.